This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
And welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name is Alex Perney, and today we are very pleased to welcome on Jeremy Goff with Hiram Capital, the managing partner and founder. And we're going to be discussing a pretty interesting topic today, if I do say so. We've covered numerous topics on this podcast, from anything to do with real estate to investing into cryptocurrencies to all sorts of different things, but we've never touched investing in railroads, and that's what we're going to be covering today. So I'm very excited to dive into the topic at hand. Jeremy, if you wouldn't mind, give us a little bit of background about yourself and kind of how you came to be at your current position with Hiram Capital, and then we'll dive into the topic of hand of investing in railroads.
Sure, Alex. Happy to do that, and glad to be on the podcast with you all. So my background, starting in this industry, I started my career in private equity with Blackstone about a little over 12 years ago. I was born and raised in Kansas City, which is where Hiram is located today, and left Blackstone and came back here and worked for a firm by the name of Tortoise Capital, which, for those that are familiar with that firm, was a large energy and infrastructure investment firm that started back in the late 90s. That's where I really got exposed to infrastructure as a whole, which railroads are a component of. And so my partner, Adam, and I, who also founded Hiram with me, when we left Tortoise, was really, you know, our goal was really to start a firm that was more boutique in nature, that focused strictly on certain components of the infrastructure market, like freight transportation and short line railroads. And so that's kind of how we got here today and started the firm and raising capital around that strategy.
Okay, great. So, you know, when people think of railroads, you know, a lot of times you just think of, you know, you're sitting at an intersection, you see a big train going across, you see things like CSX, you see, BASF, all these different kind of just big names on there. And I don't think people really kind of understand, the ownership and the, you know, structure with these things and kind of the larger encompassing, you know, kind of investment realm of logistics. There's a bunch of ways that these things get broken down. Now, maybe kind of from the high level, explain a little bit kind of how railroads are owned, because people probably just don't own, you know, from point A to point B, from like Los Angeles to Jacksonville. There's tons of different railroads out there. So maybe kind of for the layperson, which I am definitely going to assume I am in that category of lay people when it comes to investing in these things, what exactly, you know, is it to own a railroad? Do the transit and logistics companies typically own the rail that they're transporting over? Are some of them co-owned? Is it something where it's like a toll road, for example? Maybe give us a little bit of an idea of just, you know, when you see a railroad, what exactly does that mean? Who owns it? And how does kind of, you know, capital get generated from that type of thing, if you will?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, I think, you know, it's a really big question, actually. I know it sounds strange, but, you know, as you kind of alluded to, the railroad industry has lots of different pieces that are actually, you know, different sort of value creation entities. And so I think the majority of people, when they think of a railroad, think of the big class one railroads that you mentioned, the CSXs, the BNSFs, the Norfolk Southerns, which are the primary carriers on rail. They're publicly traded, you know, very large investment grade counterparty type folks. And so they drive most of the commerce, you know, across the United States. And short line railroads are ultimately what would be the beginning and the end of that life cycle from a freight perspective, right? And so there's roughly, you know, just over 600 actually short line railroads in the United States today. And I would say of that just over 600, I would say, you know, over a third of those are still privately owned by the families who either founded them or bought them from the founders around the United States. And so, you know, generally thinking, you know, generally speaking, as you think about class one railroads, they are very bifurcated throughout the United States, meaning the West Coast railroads that are class ones are different than the East Coast railroads that are class ones. And so we typically focus, at least today, on the Southeastern United States and the East Coast United States. And those railroads tend to be the CSX and Norfolk Southern type railroads. And, for us, so that, you know, short lines are very different than class ones. We operate at much slower speeds. We use smaller locomotives. You know, for folks that are thinking about the operating company perspective, the CapEx for us is much less because we're not, you know, the rails are not getting used quite as much as they would on the Class 1 side. We do own the steel rail that our railroads operate. And in many cases, we may share locomotives with a Class 1. We may share a transload facility with a Class 1 that we're using or working with. But for the most part, we do own our own assets, and we also provide a lot of storage, rail car maintenance, and things like that for large Class 1 railroads.
Okay, great. So when someone says short line railroad, is that necessarily kind of a function of just the distance in which it covers, or is there more encompassing to someone saying, you know, this is a class, this is, you know, a different class of railroad from a Class 1? So maybe break down a little bit specifically, what exactly does short line railroad mean in the context of this investment sector?
Right, sure. In the true literal sense of the word, they are much shorter than a Class 1. So we're talking 5 to kind of 33, 35 miles, right? In some cases, you'll see some extend a little bit longer, but for the most part, they are just shorter. I would also say that given their function, you know, not necessarily doing interstate transportation in most cases, or intermodal, I guess, transportation, as you would call it, the fact they're regulated a little bit differently than Class 1s obviously are. And I think, you know, it's nice to make the differentiation, because I think when folks look at the news and they see there was this massive derailment, you know, on a railroad that caused all of these issues, that's always, generally speaking, a Class 1 railroad. It's not a short line, right? And so, but what I will tell you is the major driver of revenue for a short line is a Class 1, right? Because that's who we're generally servicing, right? Tying into those larger railroads.
So these are kind of like in the terms of logistics, kind of like last mile functions, where it's going to be like the final mile delivery to an end destination. It's not necessarily going to be something that plugs into, let's say, like the Port of Jacksonville or Port of Miami or something like that. It's going to be a little bit more specific to, like, you know, would these kind of railroads run into things that like a paper mill or something like that, where it's like the actual end user is kind of where the terminus of this thing runs. So these things, I'm assuming, are kind of industry tied, right? You know, you're going to have a specific industry that it's supporting in a certain location. Is that true, or do you kind of get a mix of different utilizations of what kind of cargo is being carried over these distances?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so it is really a function of what sort of industry we have in that market, right? So in many cases, it's not much different than what you're seeing being, you know, transported across Class 1s, meaning, you know, agriculture, materials, you know, oil and natural gas, things of that nature, right? I will say that in a lot of cases, what we're providing for the main coastal ports, such as, for example, like a Savannah and a Charleston, we provide sort of inland port access as a relief valve for them, right? So in some cases, our railroads will have an inland port that, when I say inland port, it's really a function of container storage. So we do provide that. But in many cases, in terms of regional transportation and what we're delivering, a lot of it has to do with the local industry and sort of, you know, outputs that are taking place in that area.
Gotcha. Now, I know that, you know, that can certainly probably be, you know, a big contention risk factor in doing this, because you own a railroad that goes to nothing, that you don't really have, you know, it's kind of a function of how you make money with it. So are there any certain types of industries or things that you typically stay away from that you see as kind of maybe like a dying or something that doesn't really have the support to generate revenues for your investors, or is a little bit broader than that? You know, maybe kind of touch a little bit on the strategy of kind of the industries that you see as, you know, well in support of rail, because, you know, logistics is constantly changing. From little I know about it, I know it's a very dynamic industry with regards to needs and use cases for different industries.
Yeah, so there's a number of different things we can kind of touch on with that question. I would say that, starting out sort of at a high level, you know, there are some strong tailwinds with railroads today, both short lines and Class 1s. And I think that's a function of a couple different things. One, after COVID and all of the logistical issues that we all experienced throughout that time period, I think everybody probably had packages get lost during that time period, or things not show up or show up late.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, we've started to experience sort of nearshoring and onshoring of manufacturing domestically, right? And so that particular dynamic is creating some, breathing some new life into the railroad industry, because now we're going to need them even more, right? And so what we've found is that, you know, just like like trucking or anything else, you know, our goal is to really have a diversified product set that we're delivering, or a diversified sort of services that we're providing, that so that we can kind of ride out different cycles, product cycles, right? Commodity cycles or whatever. I would say the benefit of what we also do is that we do have a storage function, which tends to be counter-cyclical. So if you have, let's say we're focused on one industry that's going through a cycle, a down cycle, or we have some sort of mild recession, typically storage will ramp up as a result of that recession, because even though you do not have maybe as much you know, consumption going on in that particular area, we do know that they're going to need that product, right? And so typically we'll ramp up storage, the storage component of what we're doing, to counteract what's going on in the market itself. I think for us, it's trying to find out or figure out different ways to service our customers, whether it's class ones or local customers. For instance, one of our railroads sits near a Shell petrochemical facility, right? And so one of the things that we've done there is provide car cleaning when those cars come off the track, right? And so it's just another area of business that short lines can take advantage of by being in that area and being near the facility. And that's something that you don't necessarily want to contract a large class one railroad to do, right? So.
Oh, that's kind of interesting, is that there's kind of adjacent revenue streams for that. Because I wouldn't even think of, like, you know, of all the things to clean, I would never think that, you know, rail cars get cleaned particularly often. You know, they're covered in graffiti and all this other stuff. But I would think from an environmental standpoint for certain cargo hauling, there definitely is.
The inside system. Oh.
Okay, so for like, yeah, because if they're going to transport something different on the internal side of it, you definitely don't want to, like, you know, dump in something that's going to get cross-contaminated. Is that what you're kind of going for?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's just one of those things that, you know, I mean, you know, and I think there's in the industry, you know, there is a large business in the rail car leasing arena, right? And so, you know, what that tells you is that there is a limited number of rail cars. And so, you have to be able to use those rail cars for different purposes in many cases. And so the ability to clean those and reuse them and so on and so forth becomes kind of a critical component for moving freight in an efficient way. And so moving those off the main class one lines, being able to clean them on a short line and then move them back over is another dynamic that we provide, right? It's another revenue stream.
Okay, great. Yeah, no, that's a good distinction to make, because I was thinking externally, but, you know, if you're transporting, let's say, ethanol in a carrier and then you have a load of methanol, you don't want to get those cross-contaminated. You're transporting corn in one and then you're going to be doing barley in another bulk carrier. You don't want a bunch of corn kernels in one of them. So that definitely makes sense. So let's kind of, again, I could get really far off in the weeds, but I kind of want to focus on the investment side of this because I really find it fascinating. So back a little bit to the functions of, you know, the interface for kind of like inland and what you were mentioning with that of storage being a component of this. So buying the railroad not only just comes with tracks, but also warehousing ability. So not only is it the need for someone saying, hey, I need, you know, this bulk of, you know, wrought iron brought from here to here. If they're not going to be utilizing it at the plant, they have to store it somewhere. And you also have the function of storage, which plays into this investment structure. Now, looking at a short line railroad, maybe let's kind of look at a deal example, if you will, of what would kind of be, you know, what you would really look for to be a really sweet deal. Is it something that involves multiple different industries? Is it something that involves a lot of other components, like the ability to have cleaning adjacent to some type of chemical manufacturer utilization? Or is it a large storage capacity? Or is that really all kind of dependent on the locale of where these things are located as to what really sweetens each individual deal?
And right-of-ways, which essentially equates to 200 to 200 feet on either side of the railroad, right? And that rail right-of-way essentially is unencumbered real estate that's associated with the railroad, whether or not it's a class one or a short line railroad. And so that provides some interesting opportunities as well, as you might guess. There's been a lot of debate over the years over whether or not that right-of-way can be used for basically anything. In really the Supreme Court, local Supreme Courts, and the federal Supreme Court have all said that, yes, they can be used for just about anything. And so that presents another avenue, an interesting avenue that really struck us as investors, that the idea that you have this large amount of unencumbered real estate in many cases that could be used for storage, warehousing, that can be leased back to farmers or the like. And so when we look at these things, we typically the value of the railroad that we're, if we're looking at a railroad, for example, and we're really focused on, from a valuation perspective, we're looking at multiples of EBITDA that are associated directly with that railroad. So in many cases, when we value a railroad, we're not even taking into account what the value of the commercial real estate potential of that railroad might be, in addition to what the operating potential is. And so typically what we have to do is, you know, we go through and see what has been used for in the past. But the interesting part of it is the development piece of that real estate is almost an entirely different value proposition than the railroad itself, right? In many cases, because we could potentially use that for customers that aren't even using the railroad per se. And so I think it's another interesting dynamic of this. And it's one of the reasons that drew my partner and I to the asset class in general is that, you know, I think, you know, there's just so much different potential growth-wise with the asset itself, but then also in the tangential assets that are associated with it, like real estate.
Well, that's interesting that you brought up as you kind of look at cash flow as a pre-EBITDA, because, you know, when I think of commercial real estate, it's always the depreciation and write-offs that are so much of a big core component of looking at what your value is to determining what an appropriate, you know, cap rate is for a projection for that particular asset. But basically, what you're kind of saying is that you're looking at this more of, you know, you're going to have a lot of ancillary benefit, which is well and good. But from the revenue standpoint is kind of where you normally look at it. Now, I think we kind of hit on kind of the core, you know, focuses of what revenue is. Obviously, someone's going to pay you to move a load from point A to point B. So there's kind of a, you know, a rate that's going to fluctuate, but you're going to have cash flow coming in from that. Then you're also going to have, you know, potential rental income or storage income, however you structure it from having warehousing. You're also going to have servicing. You know, someone needs something clean, you don't do it for free. So you have different revenue industry incomes coming in from this. But from a benefit to the investor, what kind of write-offs can really be seen with? I mean, these assets have been around for, you know, sometimes maybe 100 years in some cases, I'm assuming. You know, rail is nothing inherently new. So, you know, from a perspective of what it looks like from, you know, the investor receiving revenue, what kind of write-offs are being seen into this? Or is it more to do of a function of the structure of the entity to make sure that clients are going to be receiving, you know, not just humongous tax bills for this stuff. Like, where do you kind of see the balance of, you know, the investment play for, you know, taking advantage of some of that?
Yeah. I mean, so you, as an investor in this sort of asset, like you actually get the benefit of all of that. Right. And so when we buy a railroad, we still get the benefit of accelerated depreciation on the railroad assets themselves. Right. And so, you know, generally speaking, in a limited partnership that can flow through in a number of different ways. It's also a very strong cash flow asset like any infrastructure asset is, right? And so we're looking at it from a cash flow perspective. And then given the unique dynamics that are taking place in the market today, there's a lot of generational transfer taking place, interestingly enough, in the short line space, meaning the folks who own those railroads either have family members who no longer want to run them or for various reasons need to dispose of the asset and kind of move on with their lives. And so the valuation proposition on entry right now is pretty interesting, where typically we could find short line railroads, and we'll be talking about multiples of EBITDA here, but sort of in the high single digit, low double digit multiple of EBITDA. And the private market right now with larger infrastructure sponsors is demanding somewhere in the realm of, call it 16 to 17 times EBITDA, right? So you've got the tax perspective, you've got the cash flow perspective, which is great. And then you have this interesting multiple expansion taking place as a result of sort of this generational transition that's taking place in the industry itself. And so when we look at that, the whole picture, if generally speaking in infrastructure, you would expect 8 to 10%, let's say, on an annualized basis. Right now, in certain sectors like short lines, we're able to achieve north of 15% IRRs on an infrastructure asset that provides tax benefits, cash flow, and a strong exit opportunity. And so it's just this interesting time point in time for an asset like short line railroads, where there's just a lot more value to be had than I think we would have historically seen.
Yeah. And what's kind of interesting from the perspective of that, it also seems, you know, to make that kind of statement when, you know, previously we had said that, you know, like, you know, I think you said it was, my note here says about 600 short line railroads in the United States and roughly a third are privately owned. So, you know, take 300 of those that could be, you know, again, kind of that generational transfer coming available at any given time. you also had a whole lot of inventory. If you know, I told you there were 300 houses in the United States to buy, right? And how people would be like, okay. But obviously, this is a significantly different. But from that perspective, you know, it's, is it just a function of the fact that there's not a whole lot of players in this space that kind of, you know, obviously gives you the opportunity? Or is it just something that you need so much specialized knowledge and to do it correctly that it kind of drives people away from it? Or is it maybe a function of both?
Yeah, I think most infrastructure sponsors would tell you that the short line railroad industry in particular is one of the hardest to transact in within infrastructure. And I say that because even the folks who have large portfolios today have a hard time getting into new assets because it's a very tight-knit, closed group of people. If you're just a random PE sponsor who comes in and says, like, hey, I want to buy your short line railroad from you, you'll likely get a door slammed in your face, right? They don't want to talk to anybody who's not actually a railroader. And so for us, part of that is, one, having a management team who can do that for us, right, at the holding company level, who can get those introductions and who can make that entryway. But I also think that with the level of dry powder that large infrastructure sponsors have today, and I think we just saw another one last week, Brookfield, I think, raised $23 billion for infrastructure. You know, a $15 million short line railroad on its own doesn't move the needle, right? It doesn't make a difference to that portfolio. However, if you bundle five of those together, now we start having something interesting, right, that larger sponsors can take a look at. And so what I would tell you is that there aren't a lot of lower middle market sponsors focused on short line railroads, for one. And so there just aren't that. There's a handful of them probably. And the larger sponsors who do have a lot of capital to spend, you know, they need something that's rolled up in a little bit better package than one individual short line. And so that gives an opportunity to us to sort of create value, not only for the railroad itself, but for sponsors that are upstream from us.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. You know, I kind of assumed that, but especially with something I'm woefully ignorant of, I don't like to, you know, kind of put that out there. Oh, yeah. So, you know, you kind of look at it from the perspective, okay, so you have the market kind of identified, you have the management team in place that can actually functionally do this. Besides just, you know, the fact that these things are privately owned and they've probably been done for many generations, you know, what other kind of roadblocks are there for you? I would assume that there's a lot of governmental red tape when it comes to things that involve inter or intrastate transport of you know, goods and of raw materials like this, you know, from a bunch of different aspects. So is there as much maybe governmental things that you have to worry about with this, or maybe am I kind of overshooting on that? Because I just would think that railroads are just, you know, governed to death almost.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I even in short lines, I mean, we still have to go through the National Surface Transportation Board, right? It's regulated just like any other freight transportation entity. And so that's one sort of roadblock. Then you have sort of trust issues, because, you know, you can't own, because you start to have pricing power if you own too many short lines in one geographic region, right? If you control the pricing against one class one, you know, you can't own three contiguous short lines and start creating a monopoly, you know, so there is issues there, yeah. Right? And so, which again creates an opportunity for other players to come into the space and do things. And then, you know, I think the benefit of our regulation and sort of what I would call the unique sort of essentialness of what we're doing. There are a lot of, you know, benefits that we receive from the federal government and local governments to keep these things running, right? And so I think we've seen it, you know, with the Inflation Reduction Act was an addition to all of that. But we have things called 45G tax credits, which help with sort of maintenance of those railways. And then, you know, rail is actually a much less carbon intensive form of freight transportation, as much as you might not think so, it is. And so the federal government, in our endeavors, whether you believe it's right or wrong, to reduce carbon emissions in the United States, feels like rail is a better alternative to having a million trucks on the road. So, you know, I think those are things that help us. But on the other hand, you know, it's a very tightly regulated business, as you mentioned. So we have to go through all those hoops when we go through the acquisition of one of these railroads.
Yeah. And as an aside, I wholly agree with that. It's, you know, big car guy, not that this has anything to do with, you know, the podcast, but, you know, if you just think about it from a, from a fuel consumption standard, I mean, what you have, maybe, you know, your big locomotives, you know, big train lines, maybe have, you know, two, but they have maybe two or three active like locomotives on them. Each right. one of those has one, two diesel engines. So you say maybe six full diesel engines to haul 2 miles of freight cars, as opposed to right. what can you get with four diesel trucks on the road? That's, I mean, it's just, you wouldn't think so, but I do like it from that perspective. So again, I wholly agree with that. You
know, one thing I would add to that, Alex, is as much of a burden as some of these derailments have been recently, and I think in the grand scheme of things, you know, from a liability perspective too, when you think about hauling freight from one place to the other, doing it via truck, there, you know, the risks associated with a bunch of truck drivers on the road moving that freight from one end of the country to the other is a much different risk profile than, as you mentioned, a mile-long train moving from one end to the other. And so that's yeah. something, you know, I think people look at as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to mention, trains are just flat-out cool. I mean, who doesn't like a train?
Agreed. So
from that perspective, you know, I think we've pretty well covered, like, the, you know, the top-end basics of, like, you know, what short-line railroads are and they aren't. You know, kind of the difference between your Class 1 railroads that are, you know, going directly into the ports, getting everything off the cargo ships, and kind of where these things function in a market. And it's certainly, you know, absolutely, definitely needed, because places that need large amounts of freight, you know, certainly, I mean, just right down the road from me, granted, they did close down the printing presses, but there were rail tracks running right into a newspaper printing facility. You know, they need tons of paper that you can't functionally fit on a truck. So, you know, there are a lot of industries, I think people don't realize, that shortline railroads can absolutely function as a, you know, a function of making this a viable investment. So now to kind of bring this in for a landing, I want to get kind of your, you know, core thoughts on, you know, your favorite parts about the cash flows of this, why you really think this is, you know, a better investment than anything else, and what you kind of think are the ultimate really big benefits to an investor from putting this in their portfolio. You know, whether that's a great tax advantage play, whether that's a great just awesome cash flow play, like you mentioned, the IRRs that you're seeing, you know, just in comparative analysis to what the normal IRR and cap rates are for commercial real estate, which is something I am know more than I care to know about. You know, from that aspect of seeing, you know, something that has, you know, maybe, you know, your prefs being paid out at 8-9 and people are really happy with that, to an IRR and cap rates that you've kind of mentioned in this, again, kind of your thoughts and your platform to kind of give, you know, your opinions on the viability and the benefits of this as an investment structure.
Sure. So I think, for one, when you look at infrastructure as one general asset class, it's largely been institutional, right? Because it requires very large checks, and it's typically, you know, it's typically a what I would say is a low stable return, right? A cash flow return of, you know, call it somewhere around 8 to 10%. And, you know, I think generally speaking, when large institutions, pensions, funds, and the like start to underwrite these, it matches up with their liabilities very well from a cash flow perspective. And so what I would say is, like, this is very different, right? And so what we've found is that when I say non-institutional, I mean family offices down to kind of high net worth. What's interesting to them is that, one, they've never gotten access to infrastructure like this before, because it's typically, again, been reserved for large institutions that can write, you know, $50, $100 million checks or more, and are just looking for that 8% preferred return cash flow just to kind of keep coming in. And so what we've tried to do is make this sort of available more to everyone, right? And in doing so, we looked into an industry like short line railroads, which, as you mentioned early on, most people don't even realize that they can invest in a short line railroad, right? I mean, they know that they can go buy BNSF stock today, you know, on the market, but they don't realize that they can privately invest in something like a short line railroad. And not only do they realize that, they don't realize that there's tax benefits. They don't realize that there's still a cash flow component, albeit I would say the cash flow component is nice, but there's also this great valuation opportunity on the back end of this, where, you know, you can basically create a multiple of invested cash flow or multiple of invested cash that's much different than any other infrastructure asset class out there. And so it's one of those things where, you know, you have to find folks who can actually get into that space. And so it's unique access. You still have great cash flow. We still hurdle a preferred return of 8%, but we're underwriting to 15 to 20, which in most cases is what you would expect from a general private equity fund, right? That's doing leverage buyouts in just about every industry. And so it's infrastructure, what I would call infrastructure on steroids, but it's really the size of it, it makes it more accessible to family offices and high net worth investors than infrastructure ever was before. And the beauty in this is that, you know, railroads have about the highest barrier to entry in the United States that there is. I mean, the idea that you could go out and build a competing railroad next door to one of the ones we own, it's just not going to happen, right? It's just, I mean, that's kind of done. And so you've got this insulated industry that tends to be very critical in nature to the economy as a whole, and you can't keep building them. And so you've got this sort of unique moment in time to kind of touch these things.
No, absolutely. And I think those are some really great points to make. A few questions that have just kind of popped into my mind as it compares, because we have a lot of people that, we do this as an adjunct to what we do professionally as alternative asset administrators. And, you know, roughly, you know, I would say 50 to 60% of our invested capital for our clients is real estate or real estate adjacent. So anytime I can draw some corollaries between kind of what people are used to and new things is always a benefit. At least on the front end, I'm assuming these things are all, you know, relatively similar in, you know, it's a cap raise to a down payment for some type of debt service on this, or are these mainly cash plays?
Yeah. You know, I would say, you know, I don't know whether we're unique in this or not, because I, you know, we speak to some other sponsors that do this. You know, for us right now, just given the fluctuation in rates and the uncertainty around what debt looks like today, you know, for us, these are all equity investments, right? So in most cases, there's zero debt on what we're doing. In the events where we do have debt, it's typically asset-backed leverage lines, so that, you know, we're looking at the actual hard collateral, the locomotives, the rail, the warehouses, and underwriting those to provide leverage to the investment versus enterprise cash flow lending, which is what people are most used to seeing in buyouts. And so it's a very different picture from a debt perspective. And so when we look at it, you know, generally speaking, we're underwriting returns without leverage every time, right?
Okay.
And if there's an ability to add leverage where it makes sense modestly and improve returns, then we'll do so, in most cases, probably with some sort of asset-backed facility. But there's you won't see us doing a lot of cash flow borrowing.
Okay. Yeah. And that's, you know, again, you know, 9 times out of 10, and with a few exceptions, you know, people in the commercial real estate space, whether that be industrial, light industrial, commercial multifamily, office space, maybe it's a whole other thing right now with the impending cliff, I think that's about to hit. But you are just kind of used to that. Okay. You know, 20%, you know, institutional debt, write that into it. You know, kind of go forward from there. So that's interesting that you would say that, you know, the aim goal, at least for right now, and certainly if money becomes as cheap as it was, you know, 2-3 years ago, that might change, but that these are mainly a, you know, an equity backed play. And then kind of what I'd like to end on for that is kind of how, you know, from the investor standpoint, these are structured. Are you packaging these together as like a Reg D offering? Is there, you know, is it, you know, deal specific to each one, is structured as a limited partnership? Do you kind of change with the nature of these things? You know, how exactly do you like to package these things from an investor standpoint? If they come to you and say, hey, I'd like to invest, you know, what exactly are they acquiring for their dollars?
Right. So in almost every case, aside from maybe a co-investment type structure that we would use on an asset, we are using our limited partnership. Underneath that limited partnership is a holding company that generally buys the railroads into the limited partnership, right? So typically speaking, you would have an interest in the limited partnership, and then you would wholly own that as a limited partner, that holding company. And we also use kind of a services company to maintain the same management team over the top of all of our acquisitions, right? And so that's typically what you're buying into, is a limited partnership that owns a holding company that is considered the portfolio company within the limited partnership. And that's where the individual railroad companies sit, is within that holding company.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, it definitely is a departure from what I kind of see in the, you know, other arenas of the private stock that we, deal in, or that I've dealt in the past decade. And then further to that, what kind of restrictions or covenants on these? Are these kind of like, do they have a certain lockup? Like, is it a high degree of illiquidity? I'm assuming they're probably, probably isn't much of a market for this kind of stuff. So what kind of lockups do investors expect? Is it a 3-5 year like some other private equities, or is there some other type of buyouts that are offered to investors in these?
Yeah, so typically speaking, like it's a 10-year fund like any other P PE fund you would see with a 3-year investment period. And what I would say is, like, generally speaking, our projected hold time in most cases is somewhere around the 5-year mark. So, and the reason I say that is our goal is to go in, we purchase a railroad, and we're being very strategic about the purchase of that railroad, meaning we think there's a lot more growth that can take place early on, low hanging fruit on that railroad, which is why we're acquiring that particular railroad. And so we see most of the growth taking place in an asset in the first 3 years from a revenue growth perspective. And at that point, what we view it as is more of a stabilized asset. Okay. And as we bring those assets together under the holding company and we start to stabilize all of them, that's when they become very attractive to larger sponsors. And so that's somewhere between 3 and 5 years, like you mentioned, that we would have identified it, stabilized it in our view, which stabilizes, if you're focused on commercial real estate, it's basically meaning, like, you know, there is sort of like a plateau of growth on a railroad, meaning there's just only so much revenue you can add to a given short line, right? And so once we've reached that sort of plateau and it's stabilized, it becomes just almost a very big cash flow asset, right? And so that's when we feel like the exit timeframe is optimal.
Yeah, no, and that's interesting, because I always like to be able to kind of draw corollaries between different stuff, and that absolutely makes sense. You know, you've repositioned, you've run through a lot of your accelerated depreciation schedules and everything for a lot of that big tax benefit, and then if something's just spitting out great cash flow, you've made it a lot more attractive to, you know, a larger institutional investor to say, okay, great, I don't have to do anything, I can plug it into my portfolio, and it's just going to generate, you know, checks every month, and we don't have to touch it. So, again, I really appreciate your time today. It's been really interesting to kind of dig into the fact that this is even an available investment for people, because, again, I think a lot of people coming in think, you know, they see those railroads and like, oh, yeah, you know, maybe a Blackstone or Vanguard owns all these things, or they're just owned by the companies that you see on the side of the rail cars, when it certainly isn't the case. So I do really appreciate that. And, your desire to be on here, and two, bring us great information. So with that said, I always like to kind of give all of my guests the ability to bring everything in for a landing. They're interested in learning more about investing with your firm, or they want to get more information. How can they reach you and what best avenues?
Absolutely. So again, we're Hiram Capital. You can visit our website at www.hiramcap.com. And there's also links there to inquire. And also if anybody, you know, inquires through the show, I'm happy to take questions over email or whatever that anybody would be interested in asking. So we love to tell the story. We love to talk about short line railroads. And so would be open to anybody reaching out to us.
All right. Fantastic. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. The most valuable resource any of us have is time, because you don't get any more of it in your life. So thank you very much for spending a few minutes with us today to bring a very interesting topic to our audience. Again, my name is Alex Perney. This has been the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of The Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at AdvantaIRA.com and subscribe.